The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The UN's Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights recently organized a discussion on drug policy reform entitled Human Rights in Action, Implementing the International Guidelines on Human Rights and Drug Policy. We're going to hear part of that on today's show. But first, Harm Reduction International is a leading NGO dedicated to reducing the negative health, social, and legal impacts of drug use and drug policy. They recently hosted a discussion entitled The Death Penalty for Drug Offenses in the COVID-19 Pandemic Era. Let's hear now from Ajeng Lorasetti, Human Rights Lead at Harm Reduction International.
So last week, as Zafet has mentioned, HRI launched its latest report on the global overview of the death penalty for drug offenses. And before going into my presentation, I would like to take this opportunity to thank to my colleagues at HRI who have been very helpful during the development of this report, and a shout out to Ms. Jeda Girelli, who is now on the attendees list for being an amazing co-writer of this report. And another special thank for the external reviewers for their invaluable input on this report. So 2021 was an unprecedented year for the death penalty for drug offenses. Despite the death penalty remains a possible punishment for drug offenses in 35 countries around the world, we noted a record low number of confirmed executions. Confirmed executions for drug offenses fell 96% between 2015, where we saw 755 executions, and 2020, where we saw 30 executions. Three countries, China, Iran, and Saudi Arabia, have executed in 2020. Although we don't have the confirmed figure from China due to the lack of transparency and lack of information. Some potential elements contributed to the decrease includes the fact that some of the most resolute executioners refrain from implementing executions, such as Singapore, where this where last year we see no executions in Singapore, or declared a moratorium, such as Saudi Arabia. COVID-19 itself has slightly shifted the government's focus away from executions, and the restriction put in place in some countries might also serve as a challenge in carrying out an execution, such as in Indonesia. However, it is important to stress here that all figures given on the death penalty are underestimates of the phenomenon. Real figures are much higher, and the lack of transparency by the part of retentionist countries hinder us from getting the real figure. So despite the decrease globally, the sentiment towards the death penalty for drugs is still very much the same, if not worse. Retentionist countries have reaffirmed their favors on the use of the death penalty, and this is reflected in the 16% increase of the death sentence handed out between 2019 to 2020. At least 213 people received a death sentence for drug offenses in 2020, where at least 18 of them were handed out through virtual hearings. And worryingly, some countries are advocating for harsher, more punitive drug policy, as you can hear from some of the statements given by countries during the past 2 days of the CND event. This figure is a wake-up call for all abolitionist advocates. Executions is just the tip of the iceberg. It is the most visible part of a much more broadly problematic system. And this already problematic system got worsened during the pandemic. We noted that the pandemic has further exposed defendants to the risk of fair trial violations. In Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, for example, lawyers' access to their detained clients has been restricted. And this disruption in the process of developing a strong defense inevitably increases the risk of receiving a death sentence for the client. In China, India, and Indonesia, trials have moved online. Lawyers and their clients were left with no means to communicate or to provide advice during the proceedings, as they were in different places. There were some questions on the ability of court to examine witnesses and the defendant effectively through virtual hearings, and in some cases with poor internet connection as well. So from the technicality perspective, it is even more challenging setting if the virtual hearings must involve language interpreters for foreign nationals, defendants. We noted that at least 28 foreign nationals were sentenced to death in 2020. And some of them were sentenced to death via virtual hearings. I just wanted to close my presentation by saying a couple of things. First, that the significant reduction in drug-related executions is definitely a positive development, as it provides opportunity for countries to rethink the necessity and effectiveness of this policy. But it is still vital that advocacy against the death penalty, together with drug reform, remains on the agenda for advocates, abolitionist countries, UN agencies, and other relevant actors. And second, on this report, we included a special section where we interviewed death penalty lawyers from several countries. We hope that people would be able to read the special section, and we hope this reflection on the interaction of legal defense and activism will contribute to revitalizing conversation on the abolition.
That was Ajahn Lorisetti, Human Rights Lead at Harm Reduction International, speaking on a webinar entitled "The Death Penalty for Drug Offenses in the COVID-19 Pandemic Era." You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. As I mentioned at the top of the show, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights recently organized a webinar entitled "Human Rights in Action: Implementing the International Guidelines on Human Rights and Drug Policy." Let's hear part of that now. Here's Rodrigo Uprimini. He's a professor emeritus at the National University of Colombia and director of the drug policy area for De Justicia.
Thank you very much, and good morning. Or good very early morning from Colombia. It's 6 a.m. here. Good afternoon and good evening for all in other parts of the world. First, I want to thank the organizers for this invitation on this panel of these very important international guidelines. Second, I would like to make two very short caveats. I don't speak officially on behalf of the committee. I speak in my personal capacity. However, I think that most of my positions and visions are shared by most colleagues in the committee. And second, that's it. I will develop 4 points. I will reemphasize the importance of the guidelines. Then I will explain a little how it has been used by the committee. Third, as I am in Colombian, I will also mention how they have been used by the Colombian judiciary, the Constitutional Court, and the Conseil d'Etat, and I will finish by some very short conclusions. So the importance of the guidelines, as it has been said, is because they contribute to create a bridge between human rights law and the drug policy regime that were for a long time separated, and that was a factor that contributed that for drug policy for being one of the most important drivers of human rights violations in the last 3-4 decades. Second, these guidelines are very concrete. They provide concrete guidance to states or judges that want to see what are the obligations that the states have in relation to drug policy concerning human rights. Third, they are very well grounded. If you read the guidelines and the support documents, you will see that the different guidelines in the different aspects, the right to health, criminal justice, development, special groups such as indigenous people, women, they are grounded on sound law. So those who want to use it can be can have the guarantee that they have been studied and very well crafted. So that's why I think these guidelines have a very powerful instrument, not only for advocates but also for public officials or monitoring bodies that want to incorporate in the discussion of drug policy human rights concern, assist the obligations of states. Having said that, I turn to the second point, how it has been used by the committee of which I am part, which is the Committee on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, that have to monitor the implementation of the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. What I can say is that the committee has used the guidelines in an implicit form and in an explicit form. In an implicit form is that if you see the recent concluding observation of the committee in the last years, and especially after the guidelines, you will see a lot of coincidence with what the guideline says and what the concerns the committee states and the recommendations made by for states. Let me just mention some of them. In some cases, the committee is saying you should not criminalize drug use because that would imply a violation, for instance, of the right to health, because people would be more marginalized and would suffer from this marginalization. The committee recommends decriminalizing of drug use. Second, the committee, in a sense, understand that harm reduction is part of the right to health. That is, that states should provide harm reduction strategies or programs for people in order to reduce the risks and the harms done by drug abuse and policies of drug control. Third, the committee has said several times that treatment for people who have addiction should be based on sounded scientific developments, as the guideline says, and it has recommended that in several concluding observations. And finally, in relation to illicit crops, that has not been one of the main points of the committee, but at least in two cases, in relation to South Africa and Colombia, the committee has, in a sense, used the same standards of the guidelines, either to say that you could not use herbicides to spray illicit crops unless you respect the principle of precaution and you have proof that this would not harm the population, and in others that you cannot use these eradication policies without providing alternative income or alternative means to leave to producers. And all these aspects are in the guideline. That's what we can call the implicit use. But in some cases, the committee have make an explicit use of the guidelines. That is, it has recommended the states to take into account the guidelines to draft their drug policy. It has done that at least in one case, that is in relation to the concluding observation of Benin in 2020. Then I turn to my third point, how has been the use of the guidelines in the Colombian judiciary? And I would say that the Colombian judiciary have cited explicitly the guidelines in at least three very important decisions by the highest courts of the country, two of the Constitutional Court and one of the Conseil d'État. In the ruling C-253 of 2019, the Constitutional Court cited the guidelines as providing a summary and authoritative document of the human rights standards for drug policy, and with that, it declared unconstitutional a norm that prohibited any drug use in any public space by saying that this norm was disproportionate. And second, it has used it in relation to aerial spraying. That is a big discussion in Colombia just now, just today. It has begun again by saying that any aerial spraying should follow the principles incorporated in the guidelines, especially the principle of precaution. So this shows that the guidelines can be used to support decision, and by that, by strengthening the value of the guidelines in themselves. And with that, I turn to my final and conclusive points. With these very short examples, because of the limits of time, you can see that the guidelines can be used in different ways. It can be used as, if you want, a heuristic document. That is a document that judges, activists, public official, monitoring bodies can use to see what are the standards that are relevant for drug policy. It can use it as a supportive document, that is not a legal document that provides in itself the solution of the case, but that can support other arguments that has been made by the Constitutional Court in Colombia in its decisions. And finally, I think that the more these guidelines are used by different monitoring bodies, by different judges, by different public officials, it would become an authoritative document. Its value as a legal document will increase, and I think that should be very commendable for the evolution of drug policy, for having a drug policy that really respects human rights obligation of states. Thank you very much.
That was Rodrigo Oprimini, a professor emeritus at the National University of Colombia and director of the drug policy area for De Justicia, speaking on a webinar entitled Human Rights in Action, Implementing the International Guidelines on Human Rights and Drug Policy, which was organized by the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Let's hear more from that webinar. This is Teresa Caeiro, advisor to Portugal's National Coordinator for the Problems of Drugs, Drug Addiction, and Alcohol.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, David, for your presentation. And thank you for your greetings on the Portuguese presidency now. We're very glad to be able also to chair the group who is doing the work that I'm presenting now. And good morning, everyone. I really would like to start by greeting and congratulating the organization of the side event and thanking for inviting me to have the opportunity to present this work that we have been doing so far in an expert group within the Pompidou group in the context of human rights and drug policy. Well, something has been already said by you already, Zaved and Julie. We all know that from 2010, the Pompidou Group decided to bring human rights more to the forefront of drug policy's agenda. And it's also a fact that for many years now, it has been clearly agreed at European and UN levels that the response to drug use, drug trade should be implemented in full conformity with human rights. And this issue has been gaining field in international and European policy debates. However, in spite of all the work that has been done in recent years to clarify what human rights law may require in the context of drug policy, the focus has been directed mostly to state obligations, being very helpful in better understanding them, but with some limitations on practical use. And as Zavet said, since the UNGAST 2016, there has been a growing discussion about developing human rights indicators for drug policies and the UNDP guidelines, international guidelines on human rights and drug policy that Julian Rodrigo has just spoken about, attests to the increasing readiness to actually move ahead in this direction. And so a major step in translating commitments into practice is to better understanding the situation on the ground. And so we believe that a tool that would help countries to achieve this understanding could represent really this moving ahead. And we believe the Pompidou Group today is in the unique position to make a landmark contribution to this development because it's part of the Council of Europe with its Convention of Human Rights, jurisprudence on the European Court of Human Rights, which provide clear guidance on the subject. And furthermore, this continues the group's groundbreaking work on drug policies and human rights in Europe, right? So that's why this expert group was created, expecting to develop a self-assessment tool that may provide support to each country on better understanding their reality related to this issue. So the group is participated by 12 countries, and we've been working in the tool since June 2020. And of course, we are aware there are challenges with how to measure progress in the absence of standardized indicators across many issues and across countries. And in addition, both human rights and drug policy are very broad, and bringing them together can seem quite daunting. But with this new self-assessment tool, the Pompidou Group believes that it's possible to address the challenge of practically assessing human rights in drug policy. So what's the aim of the tool that we have been working on? And the tool is based really on the international guidelines on human rights in drug policy. And the aim is to provide a straightforward entry point for human rights assessment across key issues. This assessment is envisaged as a collaborative, reflective process, and the concept is designed to recognize the variation in approaches in different contexts across countries. By linking key topics to human rights standards and more specific probing questions, it's aimed to provide a practical framework to investigate and assess the human rights implication of drug laws, policies, and practices. And maybe you're curious, well, how is it going? Is it going to compare countries? Well, the tool doesn't force us to compare countries. The tool really is not intended to identify violations, but to provide an assessment of law, policy and practices, as I said, but with a view to making human rights progress. So it doesn't follow up on judgments or recommendations of any specific human rights mechanisms. It's also important to say that the Pompidou Group will launch the tool, will publish the tool, but will not collate or publish the information that the countries will collect. So there will be no central database or uniform standards against which states will be checked against each other. No, the tool is really for self-assessment. It's an internal process to voluntarily undertake. And so let me put it in other words, we could say that the aim is not to name and shame, it's rather to support and improve. So this being said, I would like to highlight that the concept foresees a tool that is for internal, voluntary, non-comparative use. So the tool is not a comparative scorecard. And we really believe that by doing so, we can more effectively achieve progress and reform rather than by applying a violations approach that will lead to tension of policies. So how will it be used and by whom? As I already said, the application of the tool will give an understanding of the realities on the ground. So the tool is therefore for internal analysis by those who are responsible for drug policy development and implementation. And ideally, it should be put to use in collaboration with civil society and those who lived experiences as well. So how was it designed, you may ask me? Well, the self-assessment concept relies on a set of questions designed to enable concerned decision makers, as I said, as well as manager or administration of organizations to explore the human rights compliance of different drug policy options and interventions. We are also conscious, and when we were working, we spoke a lot about this, of the existing reporting obligations, high workloads in this policy sphere. So we tried not to create an extra overload of work by the tool. Therefore, the concept is designed in a way that readily available sources of information should be sufficient to conduct assessments, and standardized indicators are not required. We know there are difficulties in some countries to have standardized indicators, and across countries that would be really much more difficult. So it is true that to be practical, it cannot be all encompassing, and we recognize that some issues are not included. But in this perspective, we can also think that this tool may be an invitation to further exploration. It's meant to be an adaptable entry point. And it includes a selection of key recurring issues across social, health, criminal justice domains. So it is an invitation to work within and across disciplines and professions to explore progress, problems, and those areas where human rights issues may have been overlooked. So in this way, the application of the tool will provide a better understanding of how human rights affect drug policies. It will demonstrate how they can be instrumental in reducing the unintended effects and adverse consequences of drug policies responses. And in addition, the tool provides clear guidance on the implications of the dimensions of human rights in the development and implementation of drug policies and the obligations related to observation under international legal instruments. So to finish my presentation, I just would like to say that with this tool, the Pompidou Group wants to complement the UNDP International Guidelines on Human Rights and Drug Policy, and it will hopefully become a widely used resource and valuable asset for those who strive for human rights policies. And we really believe that a better understanding of the ways that human rights are understood in the policy context can be attained by this way and this type of assessment. So I hope this was clear. And I know it's not previewed a time for questions and answers, but we'll be gladly available to answer your questions if you'll be kind to send them by email afterwards.
That was Teresa Caeiro, advisor to Portugal's National Coordinator for the Problems of Drugs, Drug Addiction, and Alcohol. She was speaking on a webinar entitled Human Rights in Action, Implementing the International Guidelines on Human Rights and Drug Policy, which was organized recently by the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights.
Give me an H!
A.
Give me an E.
E.
Give me an M.
M.
Give me a P.
P.
What's that spell?
F.
What's that spell?
F.
What's that smell?
F.
All right.
And that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Century of Lies. Find this edition of Century of Lies along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You can also subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
So long!
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.